Exoteric and Esoteric Knowledge 315. Fold Wisdom, of which the greater phase was committed to their reverent custody and the lesser revealed to all men without discrimination. The world, however, was not left wholly devoid of truth, for the secrets of the inner life were set forth under the guise of theological fables that those whose rational faculties were awakening might sense and incline toward the more sublime verities. Sallust declares the fables of the wise to be of five orders, of which the first is the theological, the second, physical, the third, animastic or psychical, the fourth, material, and the fifth, of a mixed order. Many generations often elapsed between the appearance among men of exalted intellects able to comprehend and reconstruct from the figures and metaphors of mythology the hidden body of this spiritual learning, belief in which is now regarded as one of man's most tenacious superstitions. Yet shall we consider as pure figments of the imagination those theological systems which wholly occupied the intellectual faculties of such men as Pythagoras, Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, Proclus, Porphyry, Cicero, Epictetus, Crantor, Atticus, Galen, Plutarch, and Boethius. Is not the rational proof advanced to support the existence of this esoteric knowledge as valid in its own field as the proof adduced by science and now regarded as infallible evidence of scientific erudition? That knowledge is not the common property of all is evident from the natural superiority of one mind over another, for no two individuals possess equal faculties of comprehension. These intervals of intellect, manifest to even the most obtuse senses, can never be annihilated save by a definite process of improvement by which the lesser self equips itself to comprehend the findings of the greater. The line of demarcation then, between the hidden and the revealed, is not to be considered definite, but rather relative, for the unfolding rationality is ever rejecting the old in favor of the new which, half defined, is scarcely tangible enough to support the intellect. Thus the individual is ever engaged in tearing away the veils that drape the ascetic figure of knowledge. Yet in the words of Sir Edwin Arnold, as veil upon veil he lifts, he finds veil upon veil behind. The 316 lectures on ANC and philosophy. Elements of realization are forever elusive, and greatness or littleness of thought is dependent upon comparison for its estimation. Man is increasing in his ability to comprehend things, to orient himself in relation to place, and to estimate quantity and condition. Though the conceivable universe is actually but an anthill in cosmos, inquisitive humanity in the interests of science will eventually explore that universe to its outermost fringe and fling itself therefrom into eternity. As long as the human intellect thus involved in its own insufficiency communicates its opacity to all external natures, the term esoteric should not be applied to that which is simply unknown, but rather to that which in terms of mortal intellect is unknowable. We have but begun our struggle to master the phenomena of the physical universe. Millenniums must pass before we can hope to classify its infinite diversity and cope with the problem of eternity. Although the universe envelopes us as with a vast mantle of obscurity and isolates us in the midst of our insufficiency, yet no phenomena discoverable either by scientific apparatus or philosophic deduction can be classified as truly esoteric. The building of an improved telescope with lenses powerful enough to reveal a galaxy of stars at present invisible would in no way encroach upon the province of esoteric knowledge, for the fact that these stars may be seen, if the physical apparatus is sufficiently acute, assigns them to the category of exoteric knowledge. The term exoteric covers the area of communicable facts and includes every form of knowledge discoverable to the intellect through the sense perceptions or the physical mind. That which has been, is now, or can ultimately be recorded upon paper, discoursed upon in the lecture room, debated by polemics, or dissected by the anatomist, must perforce belong to the inferior sphere of speculation where these activities are common, and hence be exoteric. That which can be couched in the language of the mortal sphere pertains to the mortal sphere, but that which pertains to the higher spheres can never be caught upon the surface of grosser substances or sensed by ecoteric and esoteric K-knowledge 317. Duller perceptions. In one sweep the self-recommended vendors of things esoteric who herald their coming with 24-sheet posters, are thus eliminated. The communication of esoteric knowledge requires a method far more than any at the command of metaphysical Mount Ebanks. The proper custodians of this knowledge the ancient mysteries realized too well that its transmission and perpetuation were the most difficult of all tasks, in many instances bordering on the impossible. How shall we reveal to another that which entirely transcends the province of the senses, that which is non-convertible into mundane terms, and with which nothing physical is comparable? Hence the secret schools of antiquity instituted systems of definite discipline by which the whole nature was dissociated from the elements of exoteric knowledge, and through protracted effort elevated to the level of supersensuous comprehension. Zion. Having reached this state, the principles of higher knowing were then communicated to the neophyte by a method almost as arcane as the secrets themselves. A strange telepathic system was developed whereby the findings of the subtler inner perceptions were communicated without passing through that place interval which exists between ordinary intellects and interval which must be filled with words or other symbolic forms, in which the esoteric matter is necessarily lost. How then shall we define esoteric knowledge? It is the classification of those superessential elements of the pure intellect sphere where form, as man recognizes it, does not exist. It must be communicated by a method which, while it awakens no response in the sensory organisms, renders knowledge comprehensive to the inner perceptions. The subject of this inner knowledge and its method of communication has long confounded men of letters. Science cannot conceive of the human mind functioning independently of matter, nor, if consistent to their premises, can men of science admit the possibility of the mind thinking in terms independently of form. In other words, they cannot dissociate the rational processes from the similitudes of phenomena and the laws of comparison that dominate the field of material thought. 318 Lectures on Ancient Philosophy. According to Seton C., the human mind instinctively clothes its conclusions and reactions in the vestments of form, so that even before the thought is registered by the outer nature of the thinker it is habit in familiar, yes, even trite and conventional forms. What science really means, however, is not that thoughts are necessarily always related to form, but rather that until they are clothed in the elements of form they are incommunicable. In other words, thoughts for which there are no form associations must die at birth, dominated by the laws of generation and under the patronage of the goddess Demeter. The physical sphere will permit no energy to exist within its domain unless that energy abide by the dictates of matter by being clothed in the substances of matter. When thoughts abide in the mind they are thus launched into generation through words, these words which are their bodies dimming like the mortal vehicles of man, the lucidity of the inner nature. Like the human soul, word souls function imperfectly while enveloped in the grosser substances of the generating sphere. Thus, while the mind under certain conditions is capable of receiving into itself definite superphysical stimuli, it cannot communicate these attenuated impulses and still preserve their integrity. A notable example is that of the eminent psychologist Henry Havelock Ellis, who, as the result of intense functioning in the realm of psychologic idealism, became so sensitized that to him occurred what is classified under the general heading mystical experience. In his book, The Dance of Life, he writes, "Myself was one with the not-self, my will one with the universal will. I seemed to walk in light, my feet scarcely touched the ground, I had entered a new world." The effect of that swift revolution was permanent. At first there was a moment or two of wavering, and then the primary exaltation subsided into an attitude of calm serenity toward all those questions that had once seemed so torturing. Neither was I troubled about the existence of any superior being or beings, and I was ready to see that all the words and forms by which men try to picture spiritual realities are mere metaphors and images of an inward experience. I had become indifferent to shadows, for I held the substance. I had sacrificed what I held dearest at the call of what seemed to be truth, and now I was repaid a thousandfold. Hence forth I could face life with confidence and joy, for my heart was at one with the world, and whatever might prove to be in harmony with the world could not be out of harmony with me. Similar experiences are recorded in the lives of Meister Eckhart, Immanuel Swedenborg, Dante Alighieri, and Martin Luther. Scientists regard the mystical experience in a troubled sort of way, though savants more generously minded cherish the vague hope that some such experience may be their lot and thus afford them opportunity to analyze firsthand its attendant reactions. Unfortunately, the mystical experience does not occur to such pedants as are minded to dissection, or whose paper learning causes them to view lives as simply complicated mechanisms. When, therefore, the apparently miraculous does transpire, the men of letters congregate to marvel and debate, desirous of scoffing but withal perturbed. To them spirit is so intangible and the bugaboo of superstition so tenacious that they fear even to register an interest in things superphysical lest they be accused of mental senility. In the light of the persistent drift of modern thought toward materialism, it is not difficult to understand why the ancient systems of learning mean so little to the modern mind. Firmly posited upon what it terms the practical, science can discover no purpose in ceremonial or symbol, nor can it conceive any tangible good to result from chanting grave rituals to the accompaniment of the lyre. The professional standing of Pythagoras the philosopher was almost irremediably impaired by the discovery that he advocated dancing as essential to education, and that even in his advanced years he was accustomed to invoke terpsichore with true scholastic measure. Modernity cannot picture such profound and serious-minded men as Plato and Aristotle, or even the skeptical Socrates, capering with aesthetic abandon in some moonlit grove. Yet we